Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, the cruel crime of sextortion and how it led to the death of a young man.
He didn't deserve to die in the way he did, and it breaks my heart to think what his last few moments or hours of getting relentless messages and threats and the terror he must have felt and the panic. That's one of the hardest things to think because of you.
His name was Murray, and that was his mother speaking. And a prize for the journalist Dawit Isaac put the spotlight on him and the other journalists detained alongside him in Eritrea.
There are reports that say they're here and there. The reports say some of them have died, some of them are sick, they don't get all the necessary treatment. They don't have the right of visitation, and they have never been brought to any court of law.
It's Monday, the 18th of November. First, we go to Senegal. The country has a new president, a new prime minister, and now a new parliament as well. President Bassirou Diomaye Faye was voted into power in March. Alongside him came Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko, who had rallied millions of people to his cause in an epic struggle to be elected. But the ruling PASTEF party did not have a majority in parliament, so President Faye, the youngest president on the continent, called a snap election. It was a chance he took, and it paid off. Voting was peaceful, and President Bassirou Diomaye Faye's party reportedly outperformed opposition groups in early results, solidifying its dominance 8 months after assuming power. So what does this all mean? Borsa Tal is a Senegalese journalist, and she has been following events.
It went calmly, as expected. Now what we have is just a clear, transparent. That's what the President Faye promised to the population before the elections, and that's what happened yesterday. Calm elections, no violence, very few incidents across the country.
Was there a high turnout, and what were the results?
Provisionally, PASTEF, which is Ousmane Sonko's political party, PASTEF alone must have won about 120. Some people say 129, 119 seats. We have yet to see the final results. But what we understand now is that more than half of the number of 165 seats were won by PASTEF. And the rest will be scattered across other coalitions. What we do understand also is that this time around, as always, I should say, most presence of voters during the presidential elections is always higher than parliament election. But what we have now is that we have about 49.72% of people showed up, which is good, which is very, very good.
So what was President Faye trying to achieve by calling this parliamentary election? It was a snap election, wasn't it, that he called in September. So what was he trying to achieve, and will he achieve it now that the result is clear?
I think what they need is to just get back to work quickly, because from March 2024, the narrative from the government's end has always been, we need to have the space to make decisions. We need to have the space to bring about laws, amnesty law, anything related to the land, etc. So that is now given to them. It's time for them to work now. And there are no more excuses as to what they can do, because they have the majority at the National Assembly. The question was, do they have enough power? Now they do. They have the executive and they have the legislative.
So just explain to us, what is the agenda that is being set out now that there's clear power and that the president and the prime minister can go ahead and act?
Well, they will first now control the government and have action, and they can propose laws, because that is the major issue. Have the power to be able to propose laws and be able to vote in favor of those laws so that they can be applied. Because as you see at the National Assembly in general, when there is an opposition party that has some kind of power, there's always a controversy. But now there's no more controversy, because all the others will be sharing a very small number of seats. So now all the controversies that we saw in the past years may not happen again. At least time will tell.
Tell us what the laws are that they want to lay before the people or bring into the legislature, and what those laws are intended to achieve. What questions are they answering by doing this?
The first one everyone is expecting is the amnesty law. And the amnesty law was created and formatted by President Macky Sall in the last hand of his presidency to protect those he was with, his allies and himself. And that also keeps allowing people who were in favor of certain positions of the government to be able to be protected as well. What we see now is that with the recent history of over 60 people dead, and all the issues that were brought forth within this presidential election of March 2024, what people want now is the very first thing to tackle at the National Assembly is the amnesty law. And tackling this will enable the government to go after those who were behind all the killings and also be able to track down all those who took extra money as a minister or any other positions that they might have had, and that needs to be brought back to the government.
So they want to address the culture of impunity, perhaps? People.
Yes, the culture of impunity
and corruption
will be addressed. Corruption, number one. Impunity will be addressed. It has to be addressed, and it has already started. From the very beginning of their presidency, what President Faye and Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko endeavor to do first is to tackle little things, just impunity on the road, for example, or impunity in the different services that people have access to. But now what we're talking about is impunity at a larger scale. So what we have is that all those who were against Ousmane Sonko from the very start and who were in opposition right now could be exposed to this amnesty bill should it be taken down. And that's what people expect. People are expecting this new National Assembly to quickly come together and quickly vote bills about the land issues, because there were various issues across the country about land. People were taking their land by people who had more money, people from the government, etc., etc.
So are we to take it that because quite a high percentage in relation to other parliamentary elections turned out to vote, that people are actually in support of what Ousmane Sonko and President Faye want to do with the legislative majority? Because in many instances, in other cases, people might feel that the intention behind it is revenge rather than justice.
It depends on who you ask the question to. In reality, people are tired of revenge. People are kind of tired of having to go back to the past. They just want to move forward. It's been years when we consider 2021 as the start of all the issues that the country has been facing. It's been 10 years today from 2014 that Ousmane Sonko, as an opposition leader, has been going through issues facing the government of Macky Sall. Given those two big events, if I can call them that way, 10 years of struggle and 3 years of general struggle, what the country is looking for is to move forward. What the population is looking for is to turn the page and start a new chapter. Will that exempt the idea of revenge? Probably not, when we consider the fact that Ousmane Sonko is still looking at the opposition as those who fought him, those who tried to stop him. But now that it is clear, I don't think there is room for revenge. The room that we have is to move forward and to see how best we can adjust things in order for Senegal to not get back to what it were before, because the idea is not to get Senegal of 1960. What the population is looking for is to get a new Senegal, Senegal of more economic access, Senegal of peace, as always, of course, and Senegal of equality. And always remember this, Ousmane Sonko from 2014 was elected as a leader of PASTEF by people from all backgrounds. But from 2021, when he was facing the justice system, and he promised that he would win against the justice system and bring back the truth, people that followed him are more of the poor side of the population. And that's the majority of people. And so now he has the majority from the people. He has the majority from even middle class, and higher class is still struggling to trust him. And this is the conversation I've had recently with a young woman who was just telling me that we, the lower class people, we have supported him because he promised us that he would bring us to places or to a certain level of lifestyle in Senegal that the higher class doesn't want us to get to.
So the people who lost, they are not contesting anything. They're accepting these results as well.
First of all of them lost at their bureau, like their voting spot. Even the only woman that we've been praising, Anta Babacar, has also lost the voting spot, which means that all these people who were once powerful, Anta Babacar got in politics just recently, last year, I should say, but all the others who have experience of being in power, experience of either being, you know, prime minister like Amadou Ba or even the mayor of Dakar, all those people who once had power are now questioning their position in politics. It is evident that they have lost the elections. And that's why from last night, we've seen all of them write letters of congratulations to Pastef and Ousmane Sonko.
So peaceful transfer of power going on here.
Evident transfer of power. It's not just peaceful, it's evident. And when it's evident, there's nothing to question and it's just clear. This is what Senegalese people did. March of 2024, they voted massively. First round gave the power to Bassirou Diomaye Faye, which is a clear message that they want change. Now they've given even more power when we look at the percentage. We fought for you. We died for you. We mourned with you. We defended you. We've given you everything, including the National Assembly. And from last night, the position that the Senegalese people have, whether in Senegal or in the diaspora, is to sit back and watch. Bassirou Diomaye Faye is president, first round. Never seen in the history. Youngest president elected in Africa. All the qualities are put on him and raised high across the world. So for the next 4 years, what will happen most likely is that citizens from all across the world and in Senegal are just going to sit and watch and see how far the government will go with all the privileges that were given to them. When I say privileges, I'm talking about all the power, because it's a privilege to have power in this country.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Right, bye.
That's the Senegalese journalist, Borso Tal. The parents of a British teenager who took his own life after becoming a victim of sextortion have made a direct appeal to criminals in Nigeria to stop what they call a cruel crime. Murray Dowie from Scotland was only 16 when he ended his life last year. It's thought that he'd been tricked online by criminals somewhere in West Africa into sending intimate pictures of himself before being blackmailed. Murray's mother and father have also condemned social media companies for not doing enough to protect young people. The BBC's Angus Crawford has been investigating. We've spoken about sextortion on Focus on Africa, but for those who don't know, just remind us who Murray was and what had happened to him.
Well, his parents describe him as a lovely boy with a great sense of humour. He loved his football. He was a huge supporter of his local football team. He was at secondary school, a very ordinary, somewhat happy-go-lucky young man. But something absolutely terrible befell his family in December last year. Roz and Mark are his parents, and they describe what happened to Murray.
He went up to his room, and he was absolutely fine. And, you know, we found him dead the next morning.
And we had no chance to intervene, to notice there was something wrong, and try and help and fix it.
It happened so quickly.
What they only learned a bit later was that Murray had become a victim of sextortion, meaning that he'd been targeted by scammers in West Africa, probably Nigeria. They pretended to be a girl online, befriended him, then tricked him into sending a compromising picture or pictures, and then threatened to blackmail him. Now, Mark says Murray must have been absolutely terrified by what was happening.
It was obviously so terrifying to him. And, you know, he was quite a private guy, Murray, and the idea of pictures being out there in his peer group must have been too much for him. And, I wish he'd come through. And that's the message here, you know, put the phone down and go and talk to somebody.
It's heartbreaking to hear Murray's father talk like that. How big a problem is sextortion, Angus?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, first of all, it's worth saying that it is underreported. I think people are embarrassed, they're shamed and they're frightened. So it is hugely underreported. But the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children in the US says that rates of sextortion have rocketed. In 2022, they had something like 10,000 reports. And in 2023, that had gone up to something like 25,000 reports. Now, this man who you're about to hear from is involved in sextortion in Nigeria. It took months for the BBC to persuade him to talk to us. And his words are spoken by a BBC producer.
You use a profile of a beautiful girl. And he will keep imagining, wow, this is my girlfriend. Well, the painful part of it is that they will never want to tell anyone when this is happening.
Angus, the person that you spoke to that we just heard from there, did they have any regrets about what had happened to Murray or about what they were doing?
Not initially, it has to be said, and he was spoken to by my colleagues in the Pigeon Service from the Lagos Bureau. They didn't want to speak to people they didn't know from outside the country. But what he first of all compared it to actually was fishing. He talked about throwing in a hook to see what kind of a fish he might get. He then also compared it to being like someone who was in the military, that if you're in the military, you should be prepared to, in his words, shoot and kill. Now, this is what he described sextortion for him as being like.
This is just like a job, like an industry. It depends on the fish you catch. You might catch small fish or a big fish.
And those words were spoken by a BBC producer. So Angus Murray's parents have made an appeal to the criminals involved in it, have they?
Well, they've got two aims, really, two very important aims. Number one is to stop young people becoming victims. So later today, they're launching a campaign across Scotland to tell parents and young people about it. And essentially, the message is, talk about this. You know, if it happens to you, there's no shame in this. There is nothing that is so shameful. It's worth dying over. So they're doing that. But also, they really want to get the message across to those in West Africa, particularly, who appear to be, in the main, those behind the sextortion scams. They want to get across the message that this has consequences. This has terrible consequences for the families involved. So Ros and Mark, as you say, have directly appealed to criminals involved in this crime.
You've ended Murray's life, you know. He didn't deserve to die in the way he did. And it breaks my heart to think what his last few moments or hours of getting relentless messages and threats and the tenor he must have felt and the panic. That's one of the hardest things, to think what his last sort of few moments or hours in life were like because of you.
You're terrorising people, children, for some money. And I don't think in any society that is in any way acceptable.
Ros and Mark, parents of Murray. Angus, what about the scale of the problem in West Africa, both in terms of those who are doing it and are people in West Africa, teenagers, being targeted as well in this way?
That's a fascinating question. The truth is, it's an enormous problem. The scale is gigantic. I mean, it's not new in a sense. Back in the day, the first 419 scams grew out of West Africa. They targeted people with phishing emails, promising riches if only those people in the West would send money. That's now morphed and transformed and is now being weaponized by a new generation, a generation who call themselves Yahoo boys. They're young men in the main who are computer savvy, who have access to the internet, and they form into groups and they use these groups to target young people using social media. They'll then hook them in, they will then blackmail them, and then they'll also have people who handle the money, who get the money in, launder it, send it out, and then they even have ways of handing on those victims to other scammers who will target them, saying that they can recover the money. It's a big deal. I mean, youth unemployment is a huge problem in Nigeria. But what's also really interesting, just as AI is affecting many other parts of our world, it's also entering the world of the sextortioners. They are now looking at using AI to fake young people, to fake images and videos of young people. And so they're moving into a new era where it is even more difficult to detect that you're about to become the victim of a crime.
Angus, thank you so much. Angus Crawford reporting for the BBC. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Eritrea is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist. The government shut down all independent media in 2001 and arrested at least 16 journalists at the same time. They've been in jail ever since then, and they've not been seen or heard from since that day. As the co-founder of Eritrea's first independent newspaper, Dawid Isaac was one of those journalists. He's been in detention without charge or trial for a very long time. But what led to the crackdown that landed him and 15 of his colleagues in jail for the last 23 years? And what is the state of journalism in Eritrea today? My colleague Tesfalem Araya is with the BBC's Tigrinya service. He's also from Eritrea. We've been talking about Dawit Isaak, who's been awarded the Swedish Edelstam Prize for defending human rights.
Dawit Isaak is a journalist, Eritrean journalist. He has a dual citizenship. He's also a Swedish citizen. He was a member of the independent newspaper, now banned, Satit, and he was arrested in September 2001.
Why?
He was part of about 11 independent newspaper editors and journalists who were detained in September 2001 as part of the general crackdown of political activists, dissents and officials by the government of Isaias Afwerki.
Was there a particular reason why he was arrested and why he's still in jail and hasn't yet appeared before a court of law or anything like that?
The story is, in 2001, senior government officials, former ministers, senior army generals, members of the National Assembly criticized the president, called for democratic reform. That was very new in the Eritrean landscape at that point. And these officials, after they were not successful raising cautions to bring change from within the ruling party, they started airing their frustrations about their own president in the new independent newspapers. So these newspapers carried the views of these former officials. The government was not happy. So on the 18th of September 2001, just after 9/11, it's widely understood that the government used 9/11 as a cover when the international attention was turning away from political issues in the country and elsewhere. So the government of Isaias Afwerki pounced on these officials. 11 of them have been detained on the morning of 18 September 2001. At that time, the statement was, these newspapers, for national security reasons, have been shut down temporarily. But we're here 23 years later, and Dawit was detained as part of that group of journalists.
Do we know anything about the other ones? Can you tell us a little bit about them? Because we're talking about Dawit now because he's won an award in Sweden, but there were other journalists as well that we'd like to know about.
Dawit Isaak is not different from the rest of the group of editors and journalists, but because he's a dual citizen, he's a Swedish, so the Swedish government and Swedish activists have been also raising his case, and he is used as to highlight the plight of the other editors and journalists. And so all of them, including him, have been held in secret detention. There are reports that say they're here and there. The report says some of them have died, some of them are sick, they don't get all the necessary treatment. The UN and other human rights groups have been accused the government of maltreating prisoners. So nobody knows. They don't have the right of visitation, and they have never been brought to any court of law. So even though some officials say they've been arrested on the grounds of national security, but there was no official charge in the court of law against them.
When was the last time they were seen in public, or, you know, any real concrete information about them, including Dawit, was given? Has his family seen him? Have their lawyers seen them? Anything, you know, concrete about them?
Never. So they're held incommunicado. The UN has been calling for any information about these prisoners, but the government was not willing to do so.
Subsequent to that, because this happened in 2001, what's been the situation as far as press freedom is concerned in Eritrea?
Press freedom is outlawed and banned despite the 1996. Remember, these newspapers that are now banned came into being after the transitional government at that time promulgated a press law in 1996. So these newspapers came into being after the declaration of that law. But now that is invalid. There is no newspaper, no independent newspaper in Eritrea today.
So there was a brief flowering then a brutal extinction. Nothing flowers now. What effect do you think that has on people in Eritrea?
Definitely, because now Eritrea has become a closed nation. There is no tolerance to expressing your views. In fact, some of these newspapers during the wars, the border war with Ethiopia and others, they were carrying content that really supported the country. So the population loved these newspapers. The circulation was growing every day. They were in demand. People really in the streets. I remember I was in Asmara then. Early in the morning, you can't get any of the copies because also they were carrying the views of the senior officials. We're talking about three former foreign ministers, defense ministers, and senior people within the ruling party and the government.
So this was then when there was this flowering of press freedom?
Yes, then. So the people wanted. So once they were shut down, the source of independent information was shut down. So people are now relying on diaspora-based media outlets.
And do they have access to the internet, free access, so that they can actually get those online publications?
In terms of internet, Eritrea is way back than any country in the world, you would say. There could be other worst cases, of course, but there is no good connection with the internet in Eritrea, and there is no data. So people cannot access information on their phones. They have to go to Wi-Fi spots to connect with the internet. It's very slow. All of them always talk about how frustrated they are. They can't even open emails most of the time. So it's very difficult.
And reporting on events in the country for journalists who are trying, or are there journalists who are trying to report events as they see them beyond government control? Is it a risky business?
It's incredibly risky. First of all, the government doesn't allow independent journalists to go freely. Even if they go, they need permit to even move in the country. So they need permits to go around the country and report on what is happening. But government is very, very strict in terms of allowing access to especially independent journalists. I can tell you, even government journalists in the country have been in and out of prison for many years. And there are actually some journalists who are still in detention. We're talking about the government's own state-owned media.
He's won this award, Dawit Isaak, and he is a symbol of the fight for freedom in Eritrea. Do you think that this would strengthen and hearten people who are in Eritrea right now, dreaming of press freedom and of freedom? Would they even know that he's won it?
Of course, there is access for people in Eritrea using satellite dishes. So in the format of television based outside the country, whether they're international or Eritrean, diaspora, exile, journalists, ran outlets, they do follow events. But we're talking about almost a generation since he was arrested. So this is an attempt. Their plight is not forgotten. And these journalists, some of them have families. Some of them have children that were born immediately after they went to prison. In Dawit Isaak's case, his daughter saw him for the last time when she was 8. She's now in Sweden. She just talked to the BBC, and you could see how harrowing this is for many families. But they feel frustrated because they feel the world has forgotten their loved ones, their fathers and their brothers, their sons, their uncles in many cases. So this is an attempt to bring their plight to now so people know about them. People talk about them, and people try to do something to secure their release.
Do you think that repression in Eritrea will end eventually? I mean, we've seen so many countries that have endured repression, and it has ended. Does it look like that could happen in Eritrea?
Definitely. I am sure at some point the country will open up. At the moment, Eritrea does not have a constitution, does not have a national assembly, parliament, or legislative body, doesn't have civil society, doesn't have independent media. But the president himself is getting old. People are now talking about change, both there been opposition in the diaspora as well, advocating for change, for political reform in the country. So, of course, when is the question? And for many, it's too late and overdue.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
BBC Tigrinya's Tesfalem Araya. Focus on Africa was put together by the sterling efforts of Bella Hassan, Victor Silva and Nyasha Michelle. Carnie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge of quality. Francesca Dunn was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Bedengi are our editors. And before we go, a reminder that you can find us on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.